for post-conviction relief filed 2 months ago on behalf of Duke Russell. Since I'm the presiding judge and will be for an unknown period of time, I am inclined to proceed with this petition. Are you prepared to do so? Rosenberg and I are on the verge of some serious laughter. Yes, ma'am, he replies at full throttle. Chad has turned pale and is once again struggling to get to his feet. Mr. Fallwright, she asks. No way, Judge, come on. The state has not even filed a response. How can we proceed? You'll proceed if I tell you to proceed. The state has had 2 months to respond, so what's taking so long? These delays are unfair and unconscionable. Have a seat, please. She nods at Rosenberg, and both lawyers sit down. Everyone takes a deep breath. She clears her throat and says, At issue here is a simple request by the defense to DNA test all 7 pubic hairs taken from the crime scene. The defense is willing to bear the expense of the testing. DNA is now used every day to both include and exclude suspects and defendants. Yet, as I understand it, the state, through your office, Mr. Fallwright, is refusing to allow testing. Why? What are you afraid of? If the testing excludes Duke Russell, then we're looking at a wrongful conviction. If it nails Mr. Russell, you will have plenty of ammunition to argue he received a fair trial. I've read the file, Mr. Fallwright. All 1,400 pages of the trial transcript and everything else. The conviction of Mr. Russell was based on bite mark and hair analysis, both of which have been proven time and again to be wildly unreliable. I have doubts about this conviction, Mr. Fallwright, and I'm ordering DNA testing for all 7 hairs. I'll appeal that order, Chad says without bothering to stand. I'm sorry? Are you trying to address the court? Chad stands again and says, I will appeal such an order. Of course you will. Why are you so opposed to DNA testing, Mr. Fallwright? Rosenberg and I exchange looks of sheer disbelief, with no small amount of humor thrown in. In our business, we rarely have the upper hand and almost never see a judge peel skin off a prosecutor. Our astonishment is hard to conceal. Chad, still standing, manages to say, It's just not necessary, Your Honor. Duke Russell was convicted in a fair trial by fair-minded jurors in this very courtroom. We're just wasting time. I'm not wasting time, Mr. Fallwright, but I believe you are. You're stalling and trying to avoid the inevitable. This tampering charge is further proof of that. I've ordered the testing, and if you appeal my order, you will only waste more time. I suggest you cooperate, and let's get it done. She glares at Chad with a withering look that rattles him. When he can't think of anything to say, she wraps up the hearing with, I want all 7 pubic hairs on this desk within the hour. It would be awfully convenient for them to simply disappear. Judge, please! Chad tries to protest. She wraps the gavel and says, Court's adjourned. Chad, of course, does not cooperate. He waits until the last possible moment to appeal her order, and the issue is sent to the state Supreme Court, where it could languish for a year or so. Up there, the Supremes have no deadline forcing them to rule on such matters, and they are notoriously slow, especially in post-conviction relief cases. Years ago, they affirmed Duke's conviction after his trial and set a date for his execution. Then they denied his first effort at relief. Most appellate judges, state and federal, despise these cases because they drag on for decades, and once they decide that a defendant is guilty, they rarely change their minds, regardless of new evidence. And so we wait. Rosenberg and I discuss the strategy of pushing hard for a hearing before Judge Marlowe. Our fear is that old Judge Rainey might recover and take his job back, though this is unlikely. He's in his early 80s, golden years for a federal judge, but a bit long in the tooth for an elected one. However, we are faced with the obvious reality that without DNA testing, we cannot prevail. I return to Holman and death row to visit with Duke. It's been over 3 months since I last saw him and delivered the news that we had found the real killer. That euphoric moment has long since passed. These days, his moods swing from raw anger to deep depression. Our phone conversations have not been pleasant. Prison is a nightmare for those who deserve it. For those who don't, it is a daily struggle to maintain some level of sanity. For those who suddenly learn that there is proof of their innocence, yet they remain locked up, the situation is literally maddening. Chapter 25. I'm driving on a two-lane highway headed east in either Mississippi or Alabama. It's hard to say because these pine forests all look the same. Savannah is the destination in general. I haven't been home in 3 weeks, and I need a break. My cell buzzes, and the ID says it's Glenn Colakirchy, the old lawyer in Seabrook. It's not him, but rather his comely little secretary, Bee, and she wants to know when I'll be back in the area. Glenn wants to talk, but would rather meet somewhere other than Seabrook. 3 days later, I walk into the Bull, a popular bar in Gainesville. In a booth near the back, I see Bee as she waves and begins scooting out. Seated across from her and spiffed up nicely is attorney Colakirchy. Blue seersucker suit, starched white shirt, striped bow tie, suspenders. Bee excuses herself, and I take her seat. The waitress informs us that the bartender just happens to be concocting his own special recipe of sangria, and we really should try it. We order 2 glasses. I love Gainesville, Glenn says. I spent 7 years here in another lifetime. Great town, great university. What's your school post? Can't remember. I don't recall mentioning it to him. Tennessee, undergrad, good old Rocky Top. He offers a slight grimace at this, says, not my favorite song. And I'm not much of a Gator fan either. Of course not. We've managed to skip the weather, which in the South consumes at least the first 5 minutes of every casual conversation between two men before the subject turns to football, which goes on for an average of 15 minutes. I am often almost rude in my desire to avoid wasting all this time. Let's skip the football, Glenn. That's not why we're here. The waitress delivers 2 impressive glasses of pinkish sangria on ice. When she's gone, he says, no, it's not. My girl found your petition online and printed me a copy. Not much of a computer man myself. Interesting reading. Well-reasoned, well-argued, very convincing. Thank you. That's what we do. Got me to thinking some 20 years ago, after Kenny Taft got murdered, there was some speculation that that episode did not go down, like Fitzner said. A lot of rumors that Taft got ambushed by his own men, Fitzner's boys. Perhaps our fine sheriff was involved in the drug trade, as you suspect. Perhaps Taft knew too much. At any rate, that case has been cold for 20 years. No sign of the killers, no evidence at all. I nod politely as he warms up. I hit my straw, and he follows my lead. Taft's partner was a boy named Brace Gilmer, who walked away with minor injuries. Seems like he may have been nicked by a bullet, but nothing serious. I knew his mother, an old client from an old lawsuit. Gilmer left town not long after the killing and never came back.
Years ago, I bumped into his mother, and we had a nice chat. She told me then, must have been 15 years ago, that Brace believed that he was also a target that night and just got lucky. He and Taft were the same age, 27, and got on well. Taft was the only black deputy and didn't have many friends. He also knew something about the Russo murder, at least according to Gilmer. Have you talked to him by chance?
We have not. We can't find him. Vicky can usually track down anyone in 24 hours, but so far Brace Gilmer has eluded us.
Didn't think so. His mother moved away some time back. I found her last week in a retirement home near Winter Haven. She's older than me and in bad health. But we had a nice chat on the phone. You want to talk to Gilmer?
Probably, I say with restraint. Gilmer is at the top of my list these days. Glenn slides over one of his business cards. On the back is scribbled the name Bruce Gilmer. The address is in Sun Valley. Idaho? I ask.
He was in the Marines and met a girl from there. His mother thinks he may not be too talkative. He got scared and left town a long time ago.
And changed his name.
Looks like it.
Why would the guy's mother give out his address if he doesn't want to talk? I ask. He circles an index finger around his ear to indicate she's crazy.
I suppose I caught her on a good day.
He laughs like he's really clever and pulls long and hard on his straw. I take a sip. His big nose is red and his eyes leak like a drinker's. I start to feel the alcohol. He continues.
And so, a few weeks ago, I was having drinks with another old fart lawyer in Seabrook. Guy you don't know. We used to be partners back in the day, but he quit after his wife died and left him some money. I told him about meeting you and about your theories and such, and I gave him a copy of your petition. He says he always suspected Fitzner got the wrong man because Fitzner wanted the wrong man. Keith knew too much and had to be disposed of. Frankly, though, Post, I just don't remember conversations like that at the time of the murder.
This old gossip is of no benefit at all. After a town rushes to judgment, it's only natural that some people take the time to reflect as the years pass. Most folks, though, are just relieved that somebody got convicted and the case is closed. I have what I need, and I'm unlikely to gather any more useful information. As he drains his glass, his eyelids begin to droop. He probably drinks his lunch most days and naps throughout the afternoon. We shake hands and say goodbye like old friends. I offer to get the check, but he's decided to have some more sangria. As I'm walking away, B appears out of nowhere, and with a big smile, says she'll see me later. Kenny Taft left behind a pregnant wife, Sybil, and a 2-year-old child. After his death, Sybil returned to her hometown of Ocala, became a schoolteacher, remarried, and had another child. Like nightfall, Frankie eases into town and finds her home, a nice split level in the suburbs. Vicky has done her research, and we know that Sybil is married to a high school principal. Their home is assessed at $170,000, and taxes last year were $18,000. There is one mortgage that is 8 years old. Both vehicles have bank loans. Evidently, she and her husband live a quiet life in a nice section of town. And Sybil does not wish to disturb her life. On the phone, she tells Frankie that she does not want to talk about her deceased husband. The tragedy of Kenny's murder was 20-plus years ago, and it took her a long time to get over it. The fact that the killers have never been found only makes it worse. No, she knows nothing that was not known back then. Frankie presses a little, and she gets upset. The line goes dead. He reports to me, and we decide to back off.
for now. Driving nonstop for 3 days from Savannah to Boise would have been easier than flying there. Because of weather somewhere in between, I sit in the Atlanta airport for 13 hours as flights fall like dominoes. I camp out near a bar and watch the stranded walk in and hours later stagger out. Once again, I am thankful that alcohol is not my temptation. I eventually make it to Minneapolis, where I am informed that my flight to Boise is overbooked. I stand by and stand by, and am finally awarded the last seat. We arrive in Boise at 2:30 a.m., and of course, the rental car I reserved is not available because the rental desk is closed. Other than the frustration, though, this is not a big deal. I have no appointment in Sun Valley. Bruce Gilmer does not know I'm on my way. Leave it to Vicky to find a really cheap motel in this famous resort area. At dawn, I drag myself into a small room in a rundown tourist trap next door in Ketchum and sleep for hours. Gilmer is employed by a Sun Valley resort as a golf course manager. We don't know much about him, but since there are no divorce records for either Brace or Bruce Gilmer, we are assuming he is still married to the same woman. Nor could Vicky find any official record of Brace legally changing his name to Bruce. Regardless, he did a nice job of leaving Seabrook behind some 20 years ago. He's now 47, a year younger than me. Driving from Ketchum to Sun Valley, I can't take my eyes off the mountains and the scenery. The weather is a dream. It was 95 and sticky when I left Savannah. Here it's about 30 degrees cooler, and if there is humidity, I can't feel it. The resort is exclusive for members only, and this is tricky. But the collar always helps. I put it on and stop at the gate. I tell the guard I have an appointment with Bruce Gilmer. He checks a clipboard as cars line up behind me. Most are probably golfers eager to tee off. He finally gives me a pass and waves me through. At the pro shop, I ask for Mr. Gilmer and get directions. His office is in a building hidden from view and surrounded by tractors, mowers, and irrigation equipment. I ask a laborer, and he points to a man standing under a terrace talking on the phone. I ease behind him and wait. When the phone is put away, I step up and say, "Excuse me, are you Bruce Gilmer?" He turns, faces me, immediately notices the collar, and assumes I'm a minister of some variety instead of a nosy lawyer digging through his past. "I am. And you are?" "Cullen Post with Guardian Ministries," I say as I hand him my card. "I've done this so often my timing is perfect." He studies the card, slowly extends a hand, says, "Nice to meet you." "And you. What can I do for you?" he asks with a smile. After all, the guy works in a service business. The customer first and all that. "I'm an Episcopal priest, and I'm also a lawyer, an innocence lawyer. I work with clients who have been wrongfully convicted, and I try to get them out of prison. Men like Quincy Miller. He's my client now. Can I have a few minutes of your time?" The smile vanishes, and he glances around. "To talk about what?" "Kenny Taft." He sort of grunts and sort of laughs as his shoulders sag. He blinks a few times as if in disbelief and mumbles, "You gotta be kidding. Look, I'm one of the good guys, okay? I'm not here to frighten you or blow your cover. Kenny Taft knew something about the murder of Keith Russo, and maybe he took it to his grave. Maybe he didn't. I'm just chasing leads, Mr. Gilmer." "It's Bruce." He nods to a door and says, "Let's step into my office." Thankfully, he has no secretary. He spends his time outdoors and his office has the cluttered look of a man who would rather repair a sprinkler head than type a letter. There's junk everywhere and old calendars tacked to the walls. He points to a chair and falls into one behind his metal desk. "How'd you find me?" he asks. "Just happened to be in the area." "No, seriously."
"Well, you're not exactly hiding, Bruce.
And what happened to Brace?" "How much do you know?"
"A ton. I know Quincy Miller didn't kill Keith Russo.
His murder was a gang hit, drug dealers, and Fitzner was probably covering for the gang. I doubt I'll ever find the man who pulled the trigger, but I don't have to. My job is to prove Quincy didn't do it."
"Good luck with that."
He takes off his cap and runs his fingers through his hair. "They're all long shots. But we win more than we lose. I walked 8 of my clients out of prison."
"And this is all you do?"
"You got it. I have 6 clients right now, including Quincy." "Did you know him, by chance?"
"No. He grew up in Seabrook, same as Kenny Taft. But I'm from Alachua. Never met the man."
"So you didn't work on the murder investigation?"
"Oh, no. Couldn't get near it. Fitzner was in charge, and he kept it all to himself."
"Did you know Russo?"
"Not really. I knew who he was, saw him in court from time to time. It's a small town." "You're convinced he wasn't killed by Quincy Miller?"
100%. He ponders this for a moment. His eye and hand movements are slow. He never blinks. He's over the shock of someone from his past tracking him down and does not appear to be concerned. I say, "I have a question, Bruce. Are you still hiding?" He smiles and replies,
"Not really. It's been a long time, you know. My wife and I left in a hurry, sort of in the middle of the night, eager to leave the place behind, and for the first couple of years, I kept looking over my shoulder."
"But why? Why did you leave, and what were you afraid of?"
"You know, Post, I'm not sure I want to talk about this. I don't know you. You don't know me. I left my baggage behind in Seabrook, and it can stay there for all I care."
"Understood. But why would I repeat any of this to anyone else? You were not a witness in Quincy's case. I couldn't drag you back to Seabrook if I wanted to. You have nothing to say in court."
"Then why are you here?"
"Because I believe Kenny Taft knew something about the Russo murder, and I'm desperate to find out."
"Kenny can't talk."
"Granted. But did he ever tell you something about Russo?" He thinks long and hard and begins shaking his head.
"I don't remember anything," he says, but I doubt he's telling the truth.
He's uncomfortable here, so he does what is expected and moves to another subject.
"A gang hit. Like a contract killing?"
"Something like that."
"How can you be so sure? I thought there was no doubt Miller killed the lawyer."
"How can I be sure?" The visual of Tyler hanging just inches above the Crocs flashes through my mind. "I can't tell you everything I know, Bruce. I'm a lawyer, and most of my work is confidential."
"If you say so. Look, I'm pretty busy right now."
He glances at his watch and does a lame job of acting as though he's now pressed for time. He suddenly wants me out of the room.
"Sure," I say. "I'll be around for a few days, taking some time off. Can we talk again?"
"Talk about what?"
"I'd like to know what happened the night Kenny got killed."
"How would that benefit your client?"
"You never know, Bruce. My job is to keep digging."
"You have my number."
Chapter 26. I take a lift to the top of Bald Mountain and slowly hike down 5,000 feet. I am pathetically out of shape and have many excuses for it. Number one is my nomadic lifestyle, which prevents any chance of a daily workout in a nice gym. The low-end motels Vicky finds do not advertise such amenities. Number two is the fact that I spend far too much time sitting and not standing or walking. At 48, my hips are beginning to ache, and I know it's from endless hours behind the wheel. On the plus side, I eat and drink as little as possible and have never touched tobacco. My last physical was 2 years ago, and the doctor said everything looked fine. Years ago, he told me that the secret to a long, healthy life is to consume as little food as possible. Exercise is important, but cannot reverse the damaging effects of too many calories. I have tried to follow his advice. So to celebrate the hike, I stop at a lovely lodge near the base and consume a cheeseburger and two beers while basking in the sun. I'm sure this place can be frightening in the winter, but in mid-July, it is heavenly. I call Bruce Gilmer's office number and get voicemail. I'll pester him today and tomorrow, then leave town. I can't see making this journey again. Future conversations will be by phone, if they happen at all. I find a library in Ketchum and make myself at home. I have a stack of materials to read, including Guardian's assessment of a potential new client in North Carolina. Joey Barr has spent 7 years in prison for a rape he claims he didn't do. His victim agrees. Both have sworn that their relations were completely consensual. Joey is black, the girl is white. And when they were 17, they were caught in bed by her father, a rough character. He pressured her to file charges, point the finger, and keep doing so until Joey was convicted by an all-white jury. The girl's mother, who had divorced the girl's father and despised the man, took up Joey's cause after he was sent away. Mother and daughter have spent the past 5 years trying to convince the appellate courts and anyone else who might listen that Joey is innocent. Such is the nature of my daily reading. I haven't had the luxury of finishing a novel in years. The Brain Trust at Guardian believes that we are about to walk Duke Russell out of prison, so it's time to think about reloading our docket. I'm in a quiet reading room on the main floor of the Ketchum Public Library, with papers strewn about a small table, as if I own the place, when my phone vibrates. Bruce is getting off work and wants to talk. He drives a golf cart along an asphalt path, and we wind around the course. It's busy with golfers hacking away on a perfect cloudless day. He stops on a ridge overlooking a gorgeous fairway and puts on the brake. "Just beautiful," I say, absorbing the mountains in the distance.
"You play?" he asks.
"No, never have. I assume you have a low handicap."
"At one time, yes. But not so much now. Not enough time. A round takes 4 hours and it's hard to squeeze it in. I talked to my lawyer this morning. He's down there on the 10th green."
"What did he have to say?" I ask.
"Not much. Here's the deal, Post. I'm not going to say anything that might get me involved. Not that I know anything to begin with. I'm not signing an affidavit, and I'll ignore any subpoena. No court in Florida can touch me anyway."
"I'm not asking for any of that."
"Good. You said you wanted to talk about the night we were ambushed. How much do you know?"
"We have a copy of the file from the Florida State Police, Freedom of Information stuff. So we know the basics, know what you said to the investigators."
"Good. I didn't tell them everything, as you might guess. I got nicked in the shoulder and was in the hospital for a couple of days before I talked to anyone. Had time to think. You see, Post, I'm sure Fitzner set up the ambush and sent us in. I'm sure Kenny was the target, but they also tried to kill me, too. And they would have, but I got lucky."
"Lucky?" He holds up a hand, as if to say, "Hang on."
"It was a narrow gravel road with thick woods on both sides. Very dark, 3 a.m. We got hit from both sides in the rear, so there were several bad boys with guns. Man, it was awful. We were riding along having a laugh, not too worried about anything, and in a flash, the rear window got blown out. Bullets were popping through the side windows. All hell broke loose. I don't remember stopping the car, but I did. Slammed it in park, then slid out the door and into a ditch, bullets smacking my door and ricocheting everywhere. I heard Kenny when he got hit. Back of the head. I had my service revolver loaded and cocked, but it was pitch black. As suddenly as it started, it stopped. I could hear men moving in the woods. The thugs were not leaving. They were getting closer. I peeked through some weeds, saw a silhouette, and fired. Nailed him. That was a good shot, Post. Back in the day. He screamed and yelled something, and Post, it was not in Spanish. No, sir. I know a cracker when I hear one, and that poor bastard grew up within 50 miles of Seabrook. They suddenly had a problem. A badly wounded comrade, maybe even a dead one. He needed help, but where could they go? Wasn't my problem, really. But they backed off, retreated, vanished in the woods. I waited and waited, and noticed blood on my left arm. After a few minutes, could have been 5, could have been 30, I crawled around the car and found Kenny. What a mess. Bullet entered from the rear. Exit wound took half of his face. Killed instantly. He was also hit in the torso several times. I got his gun, crawled along the ditch for 20 or so feet, made a little nest and dug in. I listened for a long time and heard nothing but the sounds of the night. No moon, nothing but blackness. According to the dispatcher's log, I called in at 4:02, said we'd been ambushed. Kenny was dead. Fitzner was the first one there, which seemed really odd. Just like he was the first one at Russo's office. He was probably in the woods directing things, I say. Probably so. They took me to the hospital and treated my wound. Nothing bad. Just got grazed. But I asked for some meds, and they knocked me out. I told the doctors I didn't want to talk to anyone for a day or two, and they protected me. When Fitzner finally came in, along with the state boys, I didn't tell the part about nailing one of the thugs, a dude whose mother tongue was definitely not Spanish. Why not? Fitzner wanted both of us dead, Post. He wanted to eliminate Kenny because Kenny knew something, and since I was along for the ride, it was necessary to rub me out, too. Couldn't run the risk of leaving behind a witness. Think about that, Post. A sheriff elected by the people and trusted by the entire community sends two of his men into an ambush with the plan to get both of them killed. That's Bradley Fitzner. He's still alive, you know. I don't care. My dealings with him were over 20 years ago. What did you tell him in the hospital? Everything, but the part about me nailing one of his thugs. I've never told anyone that. And I'll deny it tomorrow if you repeat it. So you're still afraid? No, Post, I'm not afraid. I'm just not risking any trouble here. No word from the guy you hit? Nothing. It was before the internet and searching was more difficult. I dug enough to learn that there were 2 shooting victims admitted to Tampa's public hospital on that date. One was shot by an intruder who was caught. The other guy was found dead in an alley. I couldn't prove anything, so I lost interest. About that time, my wife and I decided to leave town. How did Fitzner treat you afterwards? The same. He was always very professional, the perfect cop, a good leader who believed in discipline. He gave me a month of paid leave after Kenny's funeral and did everything he could to show concern. That's why he was so treacherous. The community admired him, and no one believed he was corrupt. Was it known among his men? We had our suspicions. Fitzner had 2 pit bulls who ran things, Chip and Dip. They were brothers, a couple of real leg breakers who did the dirty work. Arnie had a mouthful of oversized teeth, and one of his front ones was chipped. Thus, he was called Chip behind his back. Amos had smaller teeth, but a fat lower lip that was always packed with a thick wad of smokeless tobacco, thus Dip. Below them were a few members of their team who were in on the action, the drug payoffs, but they kept all that separate from the routine business of protecting the county. Again, Fitchner did a good job as sheriff. At some point, long before I arrived, he succumbed to the temptation of drug money. He protected the port, allowed the stuff to come in, provided safe zones to store it, and so on. I'm sure he made a mint, and I'm sure Chip and Dip and the others got their share. The rest of us had good salaries and benefits. He waves at a golf cart, and two attractive ladies wave back. He follows them around a fairway, then veers over a small bridge to a secluded hideaway under some trees. When we are settled in, I ask, "So what did Kenny know?" "I don't know. He never said. He dropped a hint one time, but never finished the conversation. You're familiar with the fire that destroyed a bunch of evidence, including stuff from the Russo murder?" "Yes, I've seen the report." "When Kenny was a kid, he wanted to be a spy. Sort of odd for a black kid in a small town in Florida, but he loved spy books and spy magazines. The CIA never called, so he became a cop. He was really good with technology and gadgets. An example, he had a friend who thought his wife was fooling around. He asked for help, and Kenny, in a matter of minutes, rigged up a phone tap in the guy's utility room. It recorded every phone call, and the guy checked the tape every day. Before long, he heard his beloved cooing with her Romeo and planning their next rendezvous. Kenny's friend caught him in bed and beat the shit out of the guy. Slapped her around, too. Kenny was right proud of himself." "So what did he hear?" "Something about the evidence getting destroyed. A few days before the Russo murder, there was a rape out in the county, white on white, and the victim said she never saw the guy's face but knew he was white. The favorite suspect was a nephew of Chip and Dip's. The rape kit was stored with the other stuff because there was no room in the old headquarters. When it burned, the rape kit was destroyed, along with other valuable proof. Kenny and I were drinking coffee late one night, taking a break, and he said something to the effect that the fire was no accident. I wanted to follow up, but we got a call and took off. I asked him about it later, and he said he overheard a conversation between Chip and Dip about burning the building." He stops talking, and there is a long pause. When I realize he's finished with the story, I ease in with, "Nothing else?" "That's all I have, Post, I swear. Over the years, I've speculated that Kenny had probably wired the phones around the office. He suspected Fitchner and his gang were in on the drug loot and wanted the proof. DEA was poking around, and there was talk about the feds coming in. Could we all get busted? Would Fitchner sing and blame us? I don't know. Just my best guess. But I think Kenny was listening, and he heard something." "That's a pretty wild theory." "Yes, it is. And you have no idea what he may have heard?" "Nothing, Post. No clue." He starts the cart, and we continue our tour of the course. Every turn reveals another scenic vista of mountains and valleys. We cross rushing streams on narrow wooden bridges. At the 13th tee box, he introduces me to his lawyer, who asks how things are going. We say all is well, and he hurries off with his buddies, much more concerned with his game than any of his client's business. At the clubhouse, I thank Gilmer for his time and hospitality. We promise to talk in the near future, but both know that will not happen. It's been a long, interesting trip, but not that productive. However, in this business, that's not at all unusual. If Kenny Taft knew something, he took it to his grave. Chapter 27. Under Florida law,
Petitions for post-conviction relief must be filed in the county where the defendant is incarcerated instead of where he was convicted. Since Quincy is staying these days at the Garvin Correctional Institute, which is half an hour away from the small town of Peckham, which is at least an hour from civilization, his case comes under the jurisdiction of a rural circuit court ruled by a judge with a dim view of post-conviction relief. I really can't blame him. His docket is packed with all manner of junk claims filed by jailhouse lawyers toiling away inside the prison just down the road. The Poinsett County Courthouse is a tacky, modern creation designed by someone who didn't get paid much. The main courtroom is dark, windowless, and with low ceilings that create a sense of claustrophobia. The worn carpet is a dark maroon. The wood panels and furniture are stained a dark brown. I've been in at least 100 courtrooms in a dozen states, and this is by far the most depressing and dungeon-like. The state is represented by the Attorney General, a man I'll never meet, because he has about 1,000 underlings between him and me. Poor Carmen Hidalgo drew the short straw and got stuck with Quincy's petition. 5 years ago, she was in law school at Stetson, ranked in the middle of her class. Our file on her is thin, because we don't need to know much. Her response to our petition was nothing more than a stock answer with some boilerplate and all the names changed. She fully expects to win, especially given the attitude of the guy on the bench. The Honorable Jerry Plank has been mailing it in for years and dreaming of retirement. He generously set aside one full day for our hearing, but it's not 8 hours of work. Because no one cares about a case that is now 23 years old, the courtroom is empty. Even the two clerks look bored. However, we are watching and waiting. Frankie Tatum sits alone 6 rows back behind us, and Vicky Gorley sits alone 5 rows back behind the state. Both are wearing tiny video cameras that can be activated with their phones. There is no security at the door. Again, no one in this town or county has ever heard of Quincy Miller. If our efforts are being monitored by the bad guys, whoever they may be, this could be their first chance to see us in action. Courtrooms are public areas. Anyone can come and go at will. My co-counsel is Susan Ashley Gross, the warrior from the Central Florida Innocence Project. 7 years ago, Susan Ashley was with me when we walked Larry Dale Klein out of prison in Miami. He was guardian second, exoneree, her first. I would ask Susan Ashley to marry me today, but she's 15 years younger and happily engaged at the moment. Last week, I filed a motion asking the defendant to be allowed to sit through the hearing. Quincy's presence is not necessary, but I thought he might enjoy a day in the sun. Not surprisingly, Judge Plank said no. He has ruled against us on every pre-hearing matter, and we fully expect him to deny any post-conviction relief. Maisie is already working on our appeal. It's almost 10 when Judge Plank finally emerges from a hidden door behind the bench and assumes his perch. A bailiff recites his standard admonitions as we stand awkwardly. I glance around and count heads. In addition to Vicky and Frankie, there are 4 other spectators, and I ask myself how they could possibly care about this hearing. No one in Quincy's family knows about it. Except for one brother, no family member has contacted Quincy in years. Keith Russo has been dead for 23 years, and as far as his family is concerned, the killer was locked away a long time ago. One white male is about 50 and wears an expensive suit. One white male is about 40 and wears a black denim shirt. One white male is about 70 and has the look of the bored courthouse regular who'll sit through anything. The 4th is a white female on the front row behind us,
and is holding a notepad as if reporting. We filed our petition weeks ago and have not received a single inquiry from the press. I can't imagine who would be covering a hearing in a forgotten case in East Nowhere, Florida. Susan Ashley Gross calls to the stand Dr. Kyle Benderschmidt from VCU. His opinions and findings are memorialized in a thick affidavit we filed with our petition, but we decided to spend the money and produce him live. His credentials are impeccable, and as Susan Ashley is walking him through his resume, Judge Plank looks at Carmen Hidalgo and says,
"Do you have any serious objections to this man's credentials?"
She stands and simply says, "No."
"Good. Then he is accepted as an expert in the field of bloodstain analysis. Proceed."
Using 4 of the 8x10 color enlargements that were used at the trial, Susan Ashley leads our witness through an examination of the flashlight and the tiny specks of red matter on its lens. Judge Plank interrupts with,
"And what happened to this flashlight? It was not presented at trial, right?"
The witness shrugs because he can't testify about it. Susan Ashley says,
"Your Honor, according to the trial transcript, the sheriff testified that it was destroyed in a fire about a month after the murder, along with other evidence the police kept in storage."
"There's no trace of it?"
"Not to our knowledge, Your Honor. The state's expert, Mr. Norwood, examined these very photographs and gave the opinion that the lens of the flashlight was spattered with blood from the victim. By then, the flashlight was long gone."
"So if I understand your position, the flashlight was the only real link between Mr. Miller and the crime scene. And when the flashlight was found in the trunk of his car, he became the prime suspect. And when the jury was presented with this evidence, it deemed it sufficient for a guilty verdict."
"That's correct, Your Honor."
"Proceed."
Benderschmidt continues with his criticism of Norwood's misguided testimony. It was not based on science, because Norwood did not understand the science behind blood spatter. Benderschmidt uses the word irresponsible several times to describe what Norwood told the jury. It was irresponsible to suggest the killer held the flashlight with one hand as he fired the 12-gauge shotgun with the other. There was no proof of this, no proof of where Keith was sitting or standing when he was shot, no proof of where the killer was. It was irresponsible to say that the specks were actually blood given the small amount present. It was irresponsible to even use the flashlight because it was not taken from the crime scene. After an hour, Judge Plank is exhausted and needs a break. It's not clear if he's actually sleepy, though he does seem to glaze over. Frankie quietly moves to the back row and sits next to the aisle. As the recess is called and Plank disappears, the spectators rise and leave the courtroom. As they do, Frankie catches all of them on video. After a smoke and a pee and probably a quick nap, Judge Plank reluctantly returns for more, and Benderschmidt gets back on the stand. During his evaluation, he began to doubt whether the backspatter, the alleged bloody specks on the lens, was really blown backward and away from the victim. Using a diagram of Russo's office and other photos from the scene, Benderschmidt testifies that based on the location of the door and the likely position of the gunman, and based on the location of Keith's body and the enormous amount of blood and matter on the walls and shelves behind it, it appears unlikely that the impact of the 2 shotgun blasts would have blown blood toward the killer. To buttress this opinion, Benderschmidt produces some photos of other crime scenes involving 12-gauge shotgun victims. It's gory stuff, and after a few minutes, His Honor has had enough.
"Let's move on, Ms. Gross. I'm not sure photos from other crimes are beneficial here."
He's probably right. On cross-examination, Carmen Hidalgo goes through the motions and scores only when she gets Benderschmidt to admit that bloodstain experts often disagree.
as do all experts. As the witness leaves the stand, Judge Plank looks at his watch as if he's had a long, hard morning, and he says,
"Let's break for lunch, back at 2, and hopefully you will have something new, Ms. Gross."
He wraps his gavel and disappears, and I suspect he has already reached his conclusion. In Florida, as in almost all states, post-conviction relief is considered only when new evidence is found. Not better evidence, not more credible evidence. Quincy's jury heard from Norwood, an alleged expert on bloodstains, and though his qualifications and his opinions were viciously attacked by young Tyler Townsend, the jury unanimously believed him. With Kyle Benderschmidt and Tobias Black, our second bloodstain expert, we are in effect presenting evidence that is only better, but not new. Judge Plank's comment is quite revealing. As the man in the nice suit and the man in the black denim shirt leave the courtroom separately, they are being watched. We hired 2 private detectives to help monitor things. Frankie has already briefed them and is talking on the phone. Vicky is sitting in one of only 2 diners close to the courthouse, waiting. I go to the other diner and sit at the counter. Frankie emerges from the courthouse and walks to his car in a nearby parking lot. Mr. Nice Suit gets into a slick black Mercedes sedan with Florida tags. Mr. Black Denim gets into a green BMW with Florida tags. They leave downtown 2 minutes apart and both pull into the parking lot at a shopping center on the main highway. Black Denim gets into the Mercedes and away they go, leaving bright red flags everywhere. Sloppy. When I get word, I hustle over to the other diner where Vicky is camped out in a booth with an untouched order of fries in a basket. She's on the phone to Frankie. The Mercedes is headed south on Highway 19, and our tail has eased in behind it. Our man calls back with the tag number, and Vicky goes to work. We order iced tea and salads. Frankie arrives a few minutes later. We have seen the enemy. The Mercedes is registered to a Mr. Nash Cooley of Miami. Vicky emails this info to Maisie at home, and both women are burning up their keyboards. Within minutes, we know that Cooley is a partner in a firm that specializes in criminal defense. I call 2 lawyers I know in Miami. Susan Ashley Gross, who's eating a sandwich in the courtroom, calls her contacts. Maisie calls a lawyer she knows in Miami. Vicky pecks away. Frankie enjoys his tuna melt and fries. Cooley and Black Denim park at a fast food place in the town of Eustis, population 18,000, and 20 minutes away. What is obvious becomes even more so. The 2 men eased into town to watch the hearing, did not want to be seen together or recognized in any way, and sneaked off for a bite. As they dine, our tail exchanges cars with his colleague. When Cooley leaves Eustis and heads our way, he is being followed at a distance by another car. Cooley is a partner in a 12-member firm with a long history of representing drug dealers. Not surprisingly, it is a low-profile firm with a sparse website. They don't advertise because they don't need to. Cooley is 52. Law school at Miami, a clean record with no bar complaints. His photo online needs to be updated because he appears at least 10 years younger, but this is not unusual. After our first cursory round of research, we find only one interesting story about the firm. In 1991, the guy who founded the firm was found dead in his pool with his throat slashed. The murder remains unsolved. Probably just another disgruntled client. 2 p.m. comes and goes with no sign of Judge Plank. Perhaps we should ask one of the clerks to check and see if he is 1, alive, or 2, just napping again. Nash Cooley enters and sits near the back, oblivious to the fact that we know the names of his children and where they go to college. Black Denim enters a moment later and sits far away from Cooley. So amateurish. Using the services of a high-tech security firm in Fort Lauderdale, we sent a video frame of black denim and paid for turnaround service. The firm's facial recognition technology was primed to run the frame through the firm's many databanks. But that was unnecessary. The first databank was the Florida Department of Corrections, and the search lasted for all of 11 minutes. Black denim is Mickey Mercado, age 43, address in Coral Gables, a convicted felon with dual citizenship, Mexican and American. When Mercado was 19, he got shipped away for 6 years for, of course, trafficking. In 1994, he was arrested and tried for murder. The jury hung, and he walked. As we wait for Judge Plank, Vicky is still in the diner ordering coffee and raging through the internet. She will tell us later that Mercado is a self-employed private security consultant, whatever that means. Their identifications are stunning. And as we sit peacefully in the courtroom, it's hard not to turn around, call them by name, and say something like, "What the hell are you doing here?" But we are much too seasoned for anything like that. When possible, never let the enemy know what you know. Right now, Cooley and Mickey have no idea that we have their names, home addresses, license plate and social security numbers, and places of employment, and we are still digging. Of course, we assume that they have a file on me and Guardian and its meager staff. Frankie is nothing but a shadow and will never be caught. He's in the hallway outside the courtroom, watching and moving. There are few blacks in this town, and he is always conscious of getting looks. When Judge Plank appears at 2:17, he instructs Susan Ashley to call our next witness. There are no surprises in these hearings, so everyone knows Z. Cuffey is back in Florida. The surprise was that he agreed to testify live if we would pay his airfare. That, and I had to swear in writing that the statute of limitations has run on perjury, so he cannot be prosecuted. These days, Zeke is just happy to be free. It won't last long, and we know it, but at least he's saying all the right things about going straight. Taking the oath, he swears to tell the truth, something he's done many times in courtrooms before commencing to lie like a polished jailhouse snitch. He tells his story about chatting with his cellie Quincy Miller, who bragged about blowing off the head of his lawyer and tossing the 12-gauge in the Gulf. Zeke says that in return for his bogus testimony, his drug charges were greatly reduced and he was sentenced to time served. Yes, he feels bad about what he did to Quincy and has always wanted to make amends. Zeke makes a decent witness, but his problem is obvious. He's lied so many times that no one can be certain, especially his honor, if he's telling the truth now. Nonetheless, his testimony is crucial to our efforts because the recantations of witnesses do constitute new evidence. With Zeke's live testimony and Carrie Holland's affidavit, we have enough ammo to argue long and hard that Quincy's trial was not fair. If we are successful in getting a new trial, we can then present much better scientific evidence to the jury. Neither Norwood nor anyone like him will get near the courtroom. Our dream is getting the facts before a new jury. On cross, Carmen Hidalgo has far too much fun leading Zeke through his long and colorful career as a jailhouse informant. She has certified court records from 5 trials over the past 26 years in which Zeke lied to juries so he could walk. He admits to lying in that one, but not the other one. He gets confused and can't remember which lie he told in that case. It's painful to sit through, and his honor is quickly tiring. But the bloodletting continues. Ms. Hidalgo hits her stride and surprises us with her courtroom presence. By 3:30, Judge Plank is yawning and squinting and obviously checking out. He's exhausted and trying desperately to stay awake.
I whisper to Susan Ashley to wrap things up and let's get out of here.
Chapter 28. The day after Vicky and I return to Savannah, we gather in the conference room with Maisie to assess the case. Florida, like Alabama, does not impose a deadline on judges in post-conviction matters, so old Plank might die before he decides anything. We suspect he's already made up his mind, but he'll take plenty of time before he rules. There's nothing we can do to prod him along, and it would be counterproductive to try to do so. We are assuming that we are being watched at some level, and this provokes a spirited discussion. We agree that all digital files and communications must be upgraded and heavily secured. This will cost about $30,000, cash that's not in our beleaguered budget. The bad guys have unlimited money and can buy the best surveillance. I seriously doubt that they will snoop around Savannah and watch our movements. That would only bore them and yield no useful information. However, we agree that we must become more vigilant and vary our routines. They could have easily followed me to Nassau and tracked me as I met with Tyler Townsend. Same for Sun Valley and Bruce Gilmer. But those trips were before we filed our petition and before our names were officially entered. Of Nash Cooley, we have learned more. We have public data regarding his autos, real estate, and both divorces. Suffice to say, he makes a lot of money and likes to spend it. His home in Coral Gables is assessed at $2.2 million. He has at least three cars titled in his name, all German imports. His firm operates out of a sparkling new high-rise in downtown Miami with branches on Grand Cayman and in Mexico City. According to a friend of Susan Ashley's, some drug lawyers in South Florida are known to take fees offshore. They are rarely caught, but occasionally the feds will bust one for tax evasion. This source says that Varick and Valencia has been in the dirty business for a long time and is quite adept at advising its clients on the more sanitary ways of laundering money. Two of the firm's senior partners are veteran courtroom brawlers with many victories to their credit. In 1994, they defended Mickey Mercado on a murder charge and hung the jury. I cannot understand the logic of Nash Cooley making the six-hour drive to watch our post-conviction hearing. If he wanted a good look at me, he could have gone to our website, simple as it is. Same for Susan Ashley. All of the petitions, motions, briefs, and rulings are public record, easily findable online. And why would he run the risk of being spotted? Granted, the risk was quite low in that backward part of the state, but nonetheless, he got himself identified by us. I can assume only that Cooley was there because a client ordered him there. Mickey Mercado is a career thug who has probably worked for a cartel his entire adult life. Which cartel? We are not certain. He and two others were charged with murdering another drug trafficker in a deal gone bad, but the feds couldn't make it stick. Now he's trailing me? I make the point to the ladies that looking over our shoulders will not help Quincy Miller. Our job is to prove him innocent and not necessarily to identify the guy who pulled the trigger. I have not told the ladies everything. I seldom do. The story of Tyler and the crocodiles is one I'll keep to myself. That image never goes away. Our discussion about Tyler goes on throughout most of the day as we go back and forth with ideas and arguments. On the one hand, I feel compelled to reach out again and at least warn him that our efforts are now being monitored. On the other hand, though, the mere act of contacting him could potentially place him in danger. The same goes for Gilmer, but he does not know as much as Tyler. At the end of the day, we decide it's an important risk to take. I go online and return to From Under Patty's